You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to the School of Influence podcast, where the queen and king of influencer marketing, authors and professors Amanda Russell and Neil Schaefer, cut through the noise and dissect what makes brands and professionals influential. No fluff, just the real deal.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the School of Influence podcast. Today, we're going to be delving into a topic, or I should say an industry that we haven't looked at before in this podcast, which is the entertainment industry. And one of the amazing things about doing this podcast together with Amanda is me getting to know Amanda better and this amazing past that she has and the amazing initiatives that she is taking on right now. So I don't know how many of Amanda, I'll let you decide how much you want to, you know, to go public now. But Amanda also is involved in the entertainment industry, believe it or not, among other things. And she introduced us to really one of the veteran entrepreneurs who's done a lot of amazing things. The gentleman wears a Brooklyn Dodgers t-shirt, so you know he's going to be good. But anyway, Amanda, I'll let you continue on the introduction here.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so through some of the different things I've gotten to do, I've gotten to meet, I think, some of the most fascinating people. And today is no exception. In fact, I'm very, very excited to learn more. And I think I said in so many words that people use the term like success and mover and shaker and having influence. And just looking at our guest's career history is so inspiring to me. I don't know how he has the same amount of hours in the day as most people, but it's incredible. So Larry Namer is an entertainment and media entrepreneur who co-founded E! Entertainment Television, which is probably the most widely aware, like brand household awareness, as well as Movies USA Magazine. But he's also founded several other media companies around the globe, and he currently heads, and I'm going to probably pronounce it incorrectly, but global entertainment group, Matan Global, and he's also the COO of Fanvestor, which I will let him talk a little bit more about kind of his journey to where he is now, where he's come from and where he's gone. So Larry, thank you, first of all, so much for taking the time to sit with us and to, you know, impart your story.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It should be fun.
So the most notable that people tend to equate your name with is E! Entertainment, but you've done so much besides that as well. Like, where did that come in your life? Like, what was sort of the progression of that? Because I don't even know how someone goes about starting a television network.
That is certainly an issue. But I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and parents were... You know, my father drove a Pepsi Cola truck and my mother worked with the Department of Social Services. And there was no kid in the family that's ever gone to college. I was the first. And I ended up getting a job, what I thought was going to be a temporary job, working for a company called Sterling Manhattan. This is back in the days when nobody ever heard of cable TV. And they gave me a job as an assistant slicer, which meant every day I would go under the streets of New York into those manholes that you see the steam coming out of and stuff. And I would work putting the cables together. So Time Incorporated, which was a publishing company only at that time, bought the company. And they had a sophisticated HR, and you kind of had the Harvard and Yale guys up on Avenue of the Americas trying to figure out what it is they just bought. You know, in Stone. So I kind of became the translator between those two factions and eventually rose to be the director of operations. So I was, I think, 25, and I was the head of operations in Manhattan and had like 8 operating departments and 300 people, all of which were older than me. I was the youngest person in my group. And so I kind of grew up there. And then cable became very popular and all big cities wanted it. So there was a group that won the franchise for Los Angeles, But the caveat was, while they could build Los Angeles, they had to build it underground. Well, the only underground cable system in the country was Manhattan, and I was the one who built it. So I ended up, you know, very young, getting the job as the general manager of what was then Valley Cable, you know, which is the biggest two-way interactive cable system in the country. And it was kind of, you know, coming out to California, I became fascinated with the entertainment business, as you typically can when you come to LA and all your neighbors and friends are all in the business. And I started to notice that, you know, the movie companies were advertising movies like a week before the movie. And I said, gee, that's kind of weird because there's no time to build awareness and brand it, all the things you would typically do with a product. And I was kind of fascinated with that. And then the company I worked for sold out and they went back to Toronto. And I wasn't going from New York to LA to go to Toronto. So a friend of mine and I, Alan Marufka, we just kicked around ideas. And, you know, we came up with this thing, cable TV is like an electronic newspaper. CNN was the headlines and ESPN was sports. And but what was missing, obviously to us, but maybe not to everybody else, was the entertainment pages, which were the second most read pages in any, you know, newspaper. So we set out to, you know, raise money and start the entertainment pages of the electronic newspaper. And the reaction we get was, hey, guys, you can't wake up in the morning and decide you're going to start a TV network. People won't do that. That's big companies. You know, you need to be the timing. So the Time Warners or, you know, NBC or ABC or CBS. And we didn't listen, thank God. But we did spend 3.5 years looking for the first dollar because nobody, you know, everybody's like, you're not Rupert Murdoch. You can't start a TV network. And we ended up raising a very little bit of money. At that time, the going rate to start a TV network was somewhere between 60 and 100 million. We realized nobody was giving us that amount of money. So we managed to raise $2.5 million. And I had a friend that was teaching radio, television, film in Austin, Texas, UT. And I called him up and said, do you have a bunch of kids that need intern jobs? And he sent us a whole bunch. And we ended up starting with 11 employees and 31 interns. And
I have to stop you for a second. I'm so excited to hear this because I think I'm going to have all of my students listen to this, my UT students especially. So...
Yeah, we just love them. Tremendous work ethic. You know, the program, the radio television film program at UT.
It's amazing.
Amazingly good. These kids were so prepared. The downside for the school, I think half of them never went back because while they came for the summer for internships, the company grew. So once we went on the air, everybody just said, oh, why don't you tell us that's what you want to do? We would have given you the money 3 years ago. So, you know, for a lot of these kids who came out for the summer, by the end of the summer, they were vice presidents and, you know, they didn't want to go back to Texas.
So interesting. Now, and I'm sorry if I'm asking silly questions, but when you started the network, so you started this network, you've got a bunch of interns. Do you start with a couple shows? Did you cast actors? Did you have shows lined up? Like, I'm fascinated. How do you even go about structuring like something that's going to work to start?
Yeah. And a TV network is really something interesting because even though you're the founder and you start it, you're never going to be able to watch it all. So you're creating a product 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you're never going to see all the product that you're responsible for creating. So step A is you need to find really, really good people that you trust their judgment because they're going to create stuff and run parts of the business while you're sleeping. So, you know, that was key. But we realized early on with that limited amount of money, we're not going to dazzle anybody with special effects or, you know, anything like that. So we really focused on what I call the Mickey Mouse Club effect, looking for hosts that we thought were going to generate some emotion, whether it's good or bad. You either love them or hate them, but you couldn't wait to go home to tune in, not necessarily the program on E!, but you wanted to go home and spend an hour with Greg Kinnear or Julie Moran or Katie Wagner because you liked them, or Mark DiCarlo, which a lot of people didn't like. And Mark went on to do Studs and a bunch of other stuff. So finding those hosts were key, and that's kind of where we put our limited resources into finding those. And a lot of people say, they go, oh, you were lucky you had all those great hosts. You know, because we did get Greg Kinnear, we got Julie Moran, who went on to do Wide World of Sports, and the first woman ever to do that. And Katie Wagner went on to do Lifestyles, and Richard Blade went to K-Rock and VH1. None of those people were on TV before. So it wasn't like we picked people there. To get those first five or six hosts that we had, we put over 7,000 people on tape. So we just said, you know what? With limited resources, this is the most important thing we can do. And we just focused in on that. And we were right. You know, we picked good ones.
And what were some of the things, that's something we talk about a lot is, you know, influence. How do you select the right people or the right things that are going to end up, you know, flourishing and scaling? What were some of the things, I mean, you looked at 7,000 tapes of people. What were some of the things that you looked for? I'm sure some of them were, can't really put into words, but after watching that many people, I mean, now you've done it for so many people, so many shows in so many years. What are some of the takeaways that you know that somebody has that, I don't know if you call it star power or charisma or influence or watch factor?
Yeah, it's, it is pretty intangible and stuff, but there is something there. I mean, probably the greatest example is Greg Kinnear, who, you know, went on to be Academy Award, Greg Kinnear, and, you know, he's all over the place. But when we found Greg, he was working at a company that was doing low-budget monster movies. And we were there pitching his company on advertising with us. And he said, oh, I think I want to be a host. Could I try out? And stuff like that. And, you know, we said, yeah, of course, you know, you'll just be one of those 7,000 that we're taping and stuff. But, when Greg came in, it's kind of a famous story. He, you know, was being very friendly, wanted to say hello. And Eileen Graham, who was in charge of putting everybody on tape, kept coming in and saying, Larry, he'd like to say hello. And I'm like, gee, Eileen, I'm really busy. I can't do that. But, we had already put about 5,000 people on tape. And finally, Eileen just came in and said, Larry, you got to come in the studio to see this person. And I was like cursing. And as we went down the hall that I was busy and I didn't have time. Literally just went in the studio and Eileen cued him and I just looked at it and went, oh my God. I said, just hire him. He lit the camera.
Wow.
You just knew that, you looked at it and you said, this is a star. And, you know, then the same thing followed, you know, with Julie Moran, who, you know, was a junior Miss America and then went on to be the first woman to, you know, to host the NBA show and stuff like that. And Katie Wagner, who's Robert Wagner's daughter, you know, when she wasn't getting in trouble for things, you know, she was always in People magazine for the clothes she wore. She was an influencer before anybody used that word influencer.
Right.
And so there were things that you just looked at and said, do I want to go home from work and spend time with these people? And that was kind of the criteria that we used. And you know, we were good at picking them. I mean, I got to say, you know, looking back, I mean, it's pretty amazing what's happened with all of those hosts. And then you look at, you know, the line of people that have come out of Talk Soup and, you know, E! Hollywood True Stories and Wild on E!, the Kardashians and stuff. You know, we were pretty good at, you know, forecasting that stuff.
I'm curious, Larry. So before that, you mentioned it took 3.5 years. So from an entrepreneurial perspective, you hear about all these people, they get together with a friend, they have a great idea, they try to get money, they don't get it, and 6 months later, they stop. 1 year later, they stop. But you kept going for 3.5 years. What kept you going?
Number one, Alan and I really did look at it and self-reflect and, you know, literally once a week and go, you know, are we crazy or could we actually do this? But we were just so convinced that we were on the right track and there was nobody else in that space. I mean, the stuff that was out there was like Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and stuff, you know, which were kind of cut and dried, boring, you know, seen that, you know, before kind of stuff. And our vision for what we wanted to do is really celebrate the industry and cater those people who go to the movies. So the people who watch Entertainment Tonight were the people staying home waiting for the movie to come to television. We just decided we were going to be about people who go to the movies, and which was actually kind of a deterrent at first, because when we talked to the cable operators, they were like, no, why would we want to put that on? We don't want people going to the movies. We want them to stay home and watch HBO.
Right.
So, you know, because I was the cable operator before, I really understood that business. So we did a lot of research studies to show that people who go to the movies, or at least people that are aware of what's in the movies, tend to be better customers of HBO and Showtime and that. And when we presented it to the cable operator and said, look, the more people know about the movies, the more value they place on these services that they're paying extra for. And that really did resonate and stuff. So we got a lot of cable systems signing up. And then we used that. We would go back to the studios and say, hey, listen, you know, we now have 10 million people. You know, you should be working with us, Paramount, Disney, Universal, et cetera. So we just kept playing it off. Then we would take sign up Paramount and then go back to the cable operators and say, we just signed Paramount as a partner.
You did influencer marketing 101 the real way.
Yeah. And, you know, we did it, you know, then the trade magazines, the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, were the most important things in the media world. And there was a woman who owned the Hollywood Reporter named T.G. Wilkerson Cassell. And she was really the first person who believed in us, even when we had no money. You know, she just said, listen, I'll if you need advertising time, I'll give it to you. And at some point in time, you'll pay me back and,
wow,
you know, give me stock or whatever. So we would sign like a cable operator, and then I would take an ad in the Hollywood Reporter saying, you know, we'd like to thank this cable company for coming on. And then we would like rip those pages out and then send them to all the other studios and stuff like that. So we just kept going back and forth until we finally got them all.
That's great.
I love that. That's kind of like, I've used that trick so many times where you like, you just kind of get one hook, and then you use that one hook to get another hook. And then it's kind of like this game of leapfrog, right? Because everybody wants to know who else.
Yeah, and we did it, and we used those Hollywood Reporter ads very, very well. And, you know, we would, you know, get Paramount to sign on, and we would put in there, we'd like to thank Paramount, and we would rip that out and send it to every cable company, and, you know, and literally just kept going back and forth.
I have a question that is not something I've ever asked, and it's not usually not quite on topic, but I have to ask because I'm fascinated personally. What is it that do you think that drives you to continue, like to continue to reinvent? I mean, I'm sure it's not money anymore. It's not achievement anymore. Like, what do you think that it is that gets you up? Because many people want just one fraction of one of your businesses or career achievements would have been enough to call it a great career and retire. And yet you just, I mean, now you can talk a little bit about it, but like Fanvestor, which is an incredible platform and you very unique idea, and some of the different things that you're doing for that are very future oriented. Like, what is it if you had to think about like the why?
Yeah, most people say it's because my mother dropped me on my head when I was a baby, because there's really no history, you know, in the family of entrepreneurship or anything like that. But you know, it's I just love to learn. I probably read 50 magazines a month. I probably read 3 or 4 books a month and stuff. So I just have this insatiable curiosity about stuff. And not necessarily just media and entertainment. I mean, I did a business plan for a hobby and craft network, you know, back a while ago. And so I read every magazine on knitting and crocheting, and I put myself in classes, and I can cross stitch now and stuff like that. So I just love that discovering and learning, and I love having new things to talk about that nobody else can, you know. So when I talk to my friends about cross-stitching, they're like, look at me and, you know, go, what's wrong with you? But, you know, it's those kind of things. And even when I was still at E, I decided that I'm going to, you know, really pay attention to foreign markets. So I went off and started a company in Russia, and we actually had the number one TV show in Russia for 10 years. We started the biggest concert company there. And of course, it was a challenge, and I love challenges. And, you know, and it's always interesting when people say, well, you can't do that. You're not Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, I don't want to say I don't want to be Rupert Murdoch, but I don't, And, you know, then kind of went from Russia to China. I have a media company in China, Meitan Global. And, you know, we do programming in Mandarin. We do dramas and sitcoms and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's actually funny. China is a good example. People say, you know, what are you most proud of? And everybody expects me to say E, but it's really not. It's, I decided that at this stage of my life, I'm going to start writing comedy because I think I'm pretty funny. So I wrote a comedy about the contradictions of modern Chinese life. What happens when you have incredible economic growth in a very short period of time and people's social skills don't grow as quickly as their bank account? And so I wrote that about China, and it actually got accepted by national television, only 1.1 billion potential viewers. And we ran 70 episodes with a show called Return to the Village of Good Fortune. And, you know, for me, I go, okay, I figured out on one hand, I figured out that people like gossip, Hollywood gossip, you know, it's like big deal. I said, but writing a comedy in a country that I didn't grow up in a language that I don't speak, I said, that's to me a real achievement. And the interesting part about that is the, that show, we ran 70 episodes and went on to be nominated at the Asia TV Awards in the best comedy category. And I thought it was ironic because it was the only comedy from China nominated that year. And I said, just think about this. I said, the funniest TV show in China is written by a New York Jew. So to me, that was, you know, much more, you know, of a recognition point of, you know, the fact that sometimes I do know what I'm doing.
You know, over the, I was going to ask you about the China connection. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm curious, over the last decade, and I think this goes for influencers and social media as well, but everything seems to be more politically activated. And I think the entertainment industry is really where we see a lot of that. People, you know, not participating in the Golden Globes and all this. Now, I look at China as well to be accepted into the TV network there. Obviously, it's being actively managed. And there are things that you have to be aware of as well. How have you, you know, successfully navigated around that as the environment has changed so much over the past few years? Or maybe it hasn't.
Sure. Well, I did a lot of stuff in Russia. And, you know, like I say, I had a very popular TV show for 10 years. And, well, we started a big concert company there and worked with the mayor of St. Petersburg. We started a music festival in St. Petersburg called the White Nights Festival. And literally have had everybody there. And but I worked very closely with the vice mayor of St. Petersburg because he really had to do the real work. The mayor was the politician. Well, as it turns out, that vice mayor was named Vladimir Putin.
Oh, wow.
So when he ended up in the Kremlin, he had picked a head of the Minister of Communications, and they realized they wanted to do they needed to do media reform. If they're going to build a consumer economy, you had to bring in brands that people actually want to buy, which meant that media had to look a little bit familiar to Western marketers. So I kind of worked with them on, you know, the rewriting the regulation for media there. And then China kind of came to that same realization that they had to do some media reform. So I actually got invited in by the Chinese government. And, you know, there are advantages of not going to, you know, Harvard, Yale, and, you know, just growing up a dumb kid in Brooklyn, in that you do learn certain things. I mean, I liken going to another country as, you know, while my mom was alive, you know, she passed like 4 years ago, I would go to her house in Florida and go, oh, this is great. You know, let's go out for Italian food at 8 o'clock. And she go, no, at 5 o'clock, we're going to the deli. And I go, no, I don't eat at 5 o'clock. She go, well, if you want to be in this house, you will eat at 5 o'clock and you'll eat what I want. But it kind of did teach me, you know, I'm a guest in these other countries and I'm not there to change the way they live or change the way they think or anything there. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm there to entertain them. So I'm very respectful of other cultures. I don't go in and say, this is the way we do it in America and this is the way we're going to teach you to do it. We kind of blend in. I mean, our company in China, there's two of us that are not Chinese and the rest of the company are entirely Chinese. And the way we choose employees are we bring in interns that typically go to Western colleges or grad schools. They work for us for 2 years, and then they go back to China. So our whole team really are people who grew up in that world, speak the language, you know, native, and provide us incredible guidance on that stuff. You know, when I wrote the comedy, I had a team of 7 women writers. And the reason they're all women, because I have this theory that Chinese men are just not funny. But, you know, I would write something and they'd say, no, that's not the way we would do it in China and stuff. And you just have to say, you know what? Get it. And just, you know, take the advice of people who really know this stuff better than you. And, you know, by me being best practices in the West and them understanding the local market, we managed to create some pretty cool stuff.
You know what else this is, what I'm hearing you say, and for those that are listening, is you're using, I do a lecture on this, basically when you're going into different cultures or different countries or different kind of even like specific niche sets of groups. And championing people that are already influential in those categories. So we talk a lot about influencer marketing very differently than just a social media star. How do you use this term of influential people to leverage business? And I think that's one of the most overlooked pieces of what influencers could be powerful for, is find who's influential in the audience, especially when it comes to expanding globally or going into another market. So I think it's interesting that you talk about that's exactly what you do, what you have done and do.
Yeah. And, you know, we do that and we continue to do it. And again, we've been very successful doing it without really knowing the reason why we're successful. But, you know, we just pay a lot of attention to that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
I mean, obviously, you look at the success of the Kardashians, they're probably among the most influential in the world. And when you look at pop culture, there's no bigger influencer pop culture in the world than he. I mean, he is now in 142 countries and, you know, has mind-boggling ability to move markets and stuff like that. In China, we pay a lot of attention to, you know, who really is out there that moves the markets, not just in terms of celebrities, but just, you know, influencers with quotes around it and stuff like that. And we, you know, we bring them into the fold early on so that when we're developing projects, there's cohesive thought throughout the whole thing. Part of the problem you have in the U.S., and I have to do, is when you're dealing with the studios or the networks, everything is very siloed. So I could go in and pitch a show, and first I'll be pitching to the creative people, and when they like it, then it goes to the business people, then it goes to the legal people, then it goes to the webmaster, then it goes to the social media community manager. And by the time you're finished with it, you have this mishmash of ideas that sometimes are not terribly coherent. In places like China and Russia, we have control of the whole process. So when we come up with an idea, we can maintain that throughout the entire process. So the website relates to, you know, the original idea on the social media plan. So everything kind of matches there. So for me, it's a lot easier to work in those kind of markets than work in the U.S., actually.
Interesting. Larry, Amanda and yourself, you've hinted at Fanvestor. Tell the audience more about that.
That's the ultimate in collecting fans, the celebrities. So it's a fintech platform, first and foremost. So the platform is licensed by FINRA, a Security Exchange Commission, so that we could do securities, both debt and equity. And what it does is it takes celebrities and gives them a platform of their own so that they can offer various kinds of things that they want to offer to their fans outside of their core business. So in other words, if it's an actor or an actress, we're not looking to finance the next movie. But let's say somebody wants to start a skincare company or a wellness company or a sneaker company or anything like that. So then Fanvestor plays an active role in helping them put that together. So in some cases, they want to raise money for the company or sell off part of their existing company. So we can do that. And again, debt or equity, and accredited or unaccredited investors, because the laws changed in 2016. Working with one of the basketball coaches for the Nets in New York, Amari Stoudemire. Amari, totally into health and wellness, wanted to start a wellness company. He had the money for the company, so he didn't need to raise money into the company, but he wanted to kind of come up with these collectible product offerings for his fans before they get offered to the general public. So we have his products, and they're a company with perks. So if you buy two, you get an autographed picture, and you know, you can kind of buy the lifetime of thing, and you get to go to Brooklyn and play one-on-one against Amari and stuff like that. Charity fundraising, working with a group now that is doing, they make content, anti-bullying content that they give away to churches and schools and all of that. And, you know, they've got some really good high-level celebrities involved, like Lily Collins and Tiffany Haddish and people like that. So we're helping them do fundraising. The company is also capable of doing auctions and sweepstakes and that stuff. So it's pretty much become a one-stop shop where celebrities could feel comfortable there next to people that they, you know, relate to. So it's not like you're doing a Kickstarter, you know, a GoFundMe where you could have your product next to somebody who just invented the latest toilet bowl technology. You're in with other celebrities and stuff. And the other thing is having the comfort to know that the people you're dealing with understand the value of a celebrity as a brand. I mean, at the end of the day, these people are worth, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And it's no different than Coke or Pepsi. They are incredibly valuable brands. And you have to understand that. So by dealing with Fanvestor, they know that we understand that. And that the managers and the lawyers can go to sleep at night knowing we're not going to do anything crazy with the brand or hurt its value. So Fanvestor, it's up and running. We've probably got half a dozen projects running now, probably another two dozen going to come before the end of the year. And everything from securities first and foremost to auctions and stuff. And we're even now looking at adding NFTs, since that's the latest range. We're going to add an NFT part to our platform.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
You do it all. So who would you say, you've mentioned a couple of people, and outside of your family, like your immediate circle, family and friends, who has been, I think I might know now, but had the most impact or influence in your career? Because sometimes I'll preface this with, you know, I just think that sometimes it's just the power of like even just one person sometimes that opens a door that takes a chance on you or lends you their name that can, you know, change the trajectory of your career. And I was curious if you had somebody like that in your life.
Sure. Actually, you know, two people. I go back to, you know, my job out of college was at Manhattan Cable, Sterling Manhattan Cable, as it turned out. And then Time Incorporated bought the company. And, you know, they had made this plan to migrate from being a publishing company to becoming a media company over 10 years. So it was very aggressive. And, you know, Time Inc. was a very staid company. And, you know, you typically had to be 50 plus before you got a title and stuff like that. But in the video group, it was all brand new. So I was one of the early people in the video group. And the video group really did start Urban Cable, you know, starting with Manhattan Cable. And then we kind of spread all over the country. But, you know, also started the first people to use satellites. You know, we started HBO, we started Cinemax, and, you know, then we bought Ted Turner and stuff like that. So it was a great place to be. And, you know, the two people that had the most effect on me, and still to this day, because I still go, you know, I find myself in a dilemma and I go, well, what would Frank have done or what would Nick have done? And so one was a guy named Frank Chiano, who's my immediate boss in Manhattan. And Frank was very much like me, and, you know, not, you know, no B school kind of stuff, street kid, but rose to great heights there. And he was a very practical guy, very goal oriented. And then, you know, from Time Inc. put in a guy named Nick Nicholas to be the president. And I was very fortunate to be able to be close to him, because I was really the only person who came from that technical side that, you know, they can relate that, understood what a balance sheet was and can speak English and do all of that. So working with Nick, who later went on to become the president of Time Warner, he really gave me management style and, you know, imparted this thing about you can be tough, but you got to be fair. And everybody has to see you as fair, because then they'll take your tough decisions without rebelling them, as long as they felt that they were fair decisions. So, you know, those two guys, Nick Nicholas, Frank Chiano, were my two biggest influencers.
I love that. Neil, do you have any last questions?
Yeah, this is going to be completely off topic, Larry. And I think this is something, Amanda, we need to do whenever we meet someone from New York. When you go back to Manhattan, what is the first restaurant you go back to?
Oh, good one. That's easy stuff. Growing up in Brooklyn, so Nathan's, of course. Although Nathan's isn't what it is. There's a pizza place in Coney Island called Totono's. I'm totally into Hole in the Wall. In New York, when I want to go out, you know, for the New York thing, Le Bernardin, you know, to me, there's nothing better than Le Bernardin for seafood and fish. And, you know, it's another level. But, you know, pizza, hot dogs, another place in Brooklyn called Spumoni Gardens, you know, which has soft serve Spumoni. So those kind of things. Those are my favorites.
Yeah, we all can't wait to get back out there, huh?
I know. I haven't been so excited. It's been this is the longest it's been since I've been back to New York. So I'm so excited to get back.
No, it's good. New York is New York. I mean, there's nothing.
There's nothing like it.
Nothing like it. And no matter how much people say that it's over, it's not over.
I'm with you. So where can people, I know you guys have a show on Fanvestor now too. Where would you, of all the places to direct, to find out more of where you'd like to direct people right now listening to this? Obviously they know E and some of the big platforms, but where would you, in terms of Fanvestor, would it be Fanvestor you think that you'd like to?
You could look at fanvestor.com. You could look at ljnmedia.com, you know, which is kind of my catch-all thing for most of the stuff I do. I'm also involved in this other thing, which is kind of interesting. It's called Beauty Queen with a K.
I saw that.
And Beauty Queen is a social media content platform that starts actually in 2 weeks for the LBGQ community. Some friends from New York, Mr. D, who is the branding guy behind Ed Hardy and NARS, Richie Rich, fashion designer for people like Lady Gaga and stuff like that, who it's actually interesting because Richie is one of the original club kids out of New York. It used to be in the 90s, you couldn't get into a nightclub unless you knew one of those guys. And I was shut out of a lot of nightclubs then. But Richie and Darren started this thing really for, you know, disenfranchised youth, you know, these kids that are struggling with sex identities and stuff like that, who really can't turn to their schoolmates, can't turn to their parents. And so we're creating this platform, which is kind of a safe place where they can go and talk to people who are going through the same kind of issues they are, and, you know, and at least feel they're not alone. So that's one of my big things these days.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time and energy and words. It's been a great conversation.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the School of Influence podcast. Amanda and Neil would be honored if you spend a minute to write a review wherever you are listening to this podcast to help expose these interviews to a broader audience. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on future episodes. Even better, build your influence and ours by sharing this podcast on your favorite social media with hashtag School of Influence. We would love to hear from and engage with you.